Jyoti Hare. Maya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hare. Gopi Janna Bhava Gopi Janna Hare. Gopi Janna Bhava Gopi Janna Hare. Yashoda Nandana Braj Janarandana Yashoda Nandana Braj Janarandana Yamuna Tira Janu Sarvahari Yamuna Tira Janu Sarvahari Maya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hare. Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parvati Vichara Sutera Sri Shri Shiva Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaura Premananda. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamani Namaste Sarasvati Em Gauravana Vishwane Nivashesha Shingyavari Pashtachari Sitarani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 16, how Parikshit received the age of Kali. We're doing texts 11 and 12 today. I'll just read through 11, and then we'll do 12 responsibly, because that's the main purport. Okay? We shall attempt it. Svalankrikam shama taranga yojitang ritam ragendra dvajam ashrita purat Rito Ritashvad Vipapati Yuktaya Svasenaya Digvigjayaya Nirgata. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Maharaj Parikshit sat on a chariot drawn by black horses. His flag was marked with the sign of a lion. Being so decorated and surrounded by charioteers, cavalry, elephants, and infantry soldiers, he left the capital to conquer in all directions. Report. Maharaj Parikshit is distinguished from his grandfather Arjuna, for black horses pulled his chariot instead of white horses. He marked his flag with the mark of a lion, and his grandfather marked his with the mark of Hanumanji. A royal procession like that of Maharaj Parikshit, surrounded by well-decorated chariots, cavalry, elephants, infantry, and band, not only is pleasing to the eyes, but also is a sign of civilization that is aesthetic, even on the fighting front. Isn't it interesting that everything is beautiful and aesthetic, even when they're going to war? That's a little different culture. Okay, text 12. I do. Let's see. Padrashram keti malam cha.
Padrashram keti malam cha.
Bharatam chotaran kurun.
Bharatam chotaran kurun.
Kim Purusha Dini Varshani
Kim Purusha Dini Varshani
Vijitya Jagrahe Balam
Vijitya Jagrahe Balam
Madrashvam Ketumalam Cha
Madrashvam Ketumalam Cha
Bharata Chotaran Kurun Kim Purusha Dini Varshani Vijitya Jagrahe Balam Madrashvam Ketumalam Cha Bharatam Chotaran Kurun
Kim Purusha Dini Varshani
Vijitya Jagrahe Balam Vaishnavis. Word for word, Madrashvam, Madrashva, Ketumalam, Ketumala, Cha, also, Bharatam, Bharata, Cha, and Uttaran, the northern countries, Kurun, the kingdom of the Kuru dynasty, Kim Purusha Adini, a country beyond the northern side of the Himalayas. Varshani, parts of the earth planet. Vijitya, conquering. Jagrahe, exacted. Balim, strength. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. Maharaj Parikshit then conquered all parts of the earthly planet. Vidrashva, Ketumala, Bharata, the northern Kuru, Kimpurusha, etc., and exacted tributes from their respective rulers. Purport. Now, purport is basically descriptions of all of these varshas. Vidrashva is a tract of land near Meru Parvata, and it extends from the Gandhava Mandava Parvata to the saltwater ocean. There are descriptions of this varsha in the Mahabharata, Bhishma Parva 7:14 and 18. The description was narrated by Sanjaya to Dhritarashtra. Maharaj Yudhisthira also conquered this varsha, and thus the province was included within the jurisdiction of his empire. Maharaj Parikshit was formally declared to be emperor of all lands ruled by his grandfather, but still he had to establish his supremacy while he was out of his capital to exact tribute from each state. Ketumala. This earth planet is divided into seven dweeps by seven oceans, and the central dweep, called Jambadweep, is divided into nine varshas, or parts, by eight huge mountains. Bharatavarsha is one of the above-mentioned nine varshas, and Ketumala is also described as one of the above varshas. It is said that in Ketumala varsha, women are the most beautiful. This varsha was conquered by Arjuna also. A description of this part of the world is available in the Mahabharata. It is said that this part of the world is situated on the western side of the Meru Parvata, and inhabitants of this province used to live up to 10,000 years, Bhishma Parva 631. Human beings lived in this part of the globe are of golden color, and the women resemble the angels of heaven. The inhabitants are free from all kinds of diseases and grief. Bharatavarsha. This part of the world is also one of the nine Varshas of the Jambudvipa. A description of Bharatavarsha is given in Mahabharata. In the center of Jambudvipa is Ilavritavarsha, and south of Ilavritavarsha is Harivarsha. The description of these Varshas is given in the Mahabharata. Nagaramscha, Vanangschaiva, Nadischa, Vimalodika, Purushan, Devakalpamscha, Narischa, Priya, Darshana, Adrishta, Purvan, Sambhagan, Sadadarsha, Dananjaya, Sudanani, Chisubhani, Narischa, Sarasam, Nibha. It is mentioned here that the women in both of these Varshas are beautiful, and some of them are equal to the Apsaras, or heavenly women. Uttarakuru. According to the Vedic geography, the northernmost portion of Jambudvipa is called Uttarakuru Varsha. It is surrounded by a saltwater ocean from three sides and divided by a Sringavan mountain from the Hiranyamaya Varsha. Kimpurusha Varsha. It is stated to be situated north of the great Himalaya Mountains, which is 80,000 miles in length and height, and which covers 60,000 miles in width. These parts of the world were also conquered by Arjuna. The Kimpurushas are descendants of the daughter of Daksha. When Maharaj Yudhisthira performed a horse sacrifice yajna, the inhabitants of these countries were also present to take part in the festival, and they paid tribute to the emperor. This part of the world is called Kimpurusha Varsha, or sometimes the Himalayan provinces, Himavati. It is said that Shukadeva Goswami was born in these Himalayan provinces, and he came to Bharatavarsha after crossing the Himalayan countries. In other words, Maharaj Parikshit conquered all the world. He conquered all the continents, adjoining all the seas and oceans in all directions, naming the eastern, western, northern, and southern parts of the world. Om Jnana Tamarandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshavam Mitanena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Bancha Kalpatru Vishcha Kripa Sindhu Gevacha Pajitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So in a morning walk in July 1977, the devotees were reading different verses from the fifth canto. I think it's chapter 16 and 17, which describe the whole universe and the cosmos and how big the mountains are and this and that. And they were questioning Prabhupada a little bit about him, questioning about the height of the Himalayas because it didn't quite jive with modern geography and things like that. And finally Prabhupada said, "And it was not possible for me to digest," he laughs. "Did someone else help me too? I am a layman. I do not know." Tamalkrishna says, "Then how did you write it?" Prabhupada, "That somebody Krishna helped me. That he manufactured." Therefore, as indicated in Srimad Bhagavatam by Sukadeva Goswami, we should not try to comprehend the greater mountainous areas of the universe merely by our calculations. So as far as I can tell, we're discussing the different varshas on the planet Earth. Sometimes in other descriptions, you see different varshas and they appear to be in different planets or different areas of the world or other parts of the universe. Well, each planet will have its own varshas. I think that's sometimes why it's not real clear. But as far as I can tell, there are varshas like continents, or sometimes there are smaller divisions because it sounds like there were two or three. Like south of the Himalayas is Bharatavarsha, you know, the Indian subcontinent. Then north of them is Kimpurusha, another varsha. I don't know whether this extended all the way to the New World, what we call the New World or not. Basically, since I, unlike Srila Prabhupada, I don't feel that Krishna is directly dictating his class to me. So that's all I'm going to say about the cosmology of the Earth. I say I have no other knowledge other than what Srila Prabhupada tells us here. So Prabhupada recommends that we just accept the statements of Srimad Bhagavatam as factual. In a purport 5.6.10, he says, Shukadeva Goswami has already stated that such calculations be very difficult, even if one had a duration of life like that of Brahma. We should simply be satisfied with these statements of authorities like Shukadeva Goswami and appreciate how the entire cosmic manifestation was made possible by the external energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Our experimental knowledge can neither verify nor disprove the statements of Bhagavatam. We should simply hear these statements, If we can appreciate the extensive energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that will benefit us. And that's usually the approach that I usually take to these kind of verses, that Krishna is really great and really wonderful, and he's just created some fantastic things here, and I'm this little tiny person with a little tiny brain that I can't really understand at all. So, now, does that mean, as devotees, as Vaishnavas, do we deny science? Do we deny education? We shouldn't have any rational thought about reality or the world or our material existence? And is Krishna consciousness a religion that's based only on faith and denies logic and scientific evidence and other things? I would say very emphatically, absolutely not. Prabhupada often called Krishna consciousness a scientific process and an educational society. I don't know how many times you've heard Prabhupada say this is a science, right? This science. Isn't our best-selling big book Science of Krishna Consciousness? You know, Science of Self-Realization, probably. You know, yeah, Prabhupada liked that term, science, and of course the devotees like it, and we like to explain to that people, no, this isn't just another religion. It's science because it's based upon rationality, it's based upon logic, and even it's based upon direct experience. You know, we always say to people, well, don't just take our word for it, chant Hare Krishna and see for yourself, right? We have that confidence they will actually have some direct experience of Krishna consciousness if people try it. So it's definitely, Prabhupada would often say, we're an educational movement. Prabhupada said, in this Krishna consciousness movement, we are giving people a chance to understand the problems of life and how to solve them. It's not a sectarian movement or so-called religious movement. It is not religion. It's an educational and cultural movement. That's from the quest for enlightenment. And we know that Prabhupada wanted his disciples to be educated. He always advocated that we scrupulously, I think it's the word he used, study his books and the philosophy. He created institutions, systems for study, all the Bhakti Shastri tests and courses. He created elementary education, Gurukula, and also he was very interested in higher education, that we would establish all branches of education within our Krishna consciousness movement. And he said this is a scientific movement. He would often have devotees challenge him during morning walks, you know, try to debate with them. He would engage in different perspectives. There's a book, I don't know if it ever got published, the one on Western philosophy where Prabhupada would try to answer all the different Western philosophers and like that and give arguments. Did that get published? I haven't been able to find it or seen it around much. But anyway, Prabhupada was not one bit, I shouldn't say afraid, he was not one bit opposed to or loath to take on Western philosophy, Western science, any of them. He was not a bit intimidated because he knew he had the absolute truth and Krishna was dictating this to him. He also established the Bhaktivedanta Institute. This was, of course, an institute, we all know, of scientists, PhDs. And he gave them the mission to apply science to the study of Krishna consciousness. I know Rasaraj is one of the, you know, big devotees in the BI now in India. And he has this idea. He's so intelligent, basically, I don't understand anything he says. But he has this idea that he's going to come up with this grand theory of epistemology and, you know, in other words, in metaphysics, where he's going to prove scientifically, beyond a shadow of doubt, the existence of God. Okay. Well, I mean, that's what Prabhupada wanted him to do, you know. In other words, through science, show that there is God. And the other part of it was, through Krishna consciousness, show the scientists that there's more than that. In other words, you know, Prabhupada would say, philosophy without religion is pure as mental speculation. But religion without philosophy is sentimental, right? So we need both. You know, we need logic, we need philosophy, then we also need, when he says religion, we also need that which comes from the heart, bhakti, devotional service. That has to be there. We have to have both the mind, I'm going to say the mind and the heart, that's not very Vedic, but that's the idea, right? We need to have both there, intelligence, and we have to have devotion. So, yes, Prabhupada wanted us to use this science of Krishna consciousness. Of course, I quote this several times in my classes, but on my initiation letter, Prabhupada said, "You are all intelligent boys and girls. Therefore, my request to you is that you study the science of Krishna consciousness and solve all the problems of the world by systematic propaganda as far as you are able to do it." That was the out. Well, he was very kind to us, calling us intelligent, but generally speaking, the devotees were like college students, and I mean, you know, they were, in fact, I would say probably most of the most intelligent people I've met in my life have been devotees. I was always surprised. I always thought I was so smart until I met the devotees, and I didn't feel quite so puffed up. But he did not say give up your intelligence. He said apply it to study this philosophy. And he called it the science of Krishna consciousness. And those are a couple of my takeaways from that. So we use material knowledge whenever needed. And of course, particularly in the service of Krishna. That's the principle of Yukta Vairagya that Rupa Goswami established. I mean, that is a very principal part of our philosophy. We don't say, I'm detached from everything. We know. We say, you know, Prabhupada would say, the impersonalist sannyasi says, no, I can't touch money. He says, no. I say, give me money so I can use it for Krishna. You know, and that's, I mean, that was, you know, kind of an exaggerated way of putting it. But, you know, that's the idea. We can use everything for Krishna's service. In fact, we can use knowledge for Krishna's service. So I was thinking, the other day I was driving up, well, about several months ago, I was driving up towards Lake Butler back on that back road, 231. Anyway, there's a big bridge when you get over Union County. And they had it shut down for a long time, fixing the bridge, and finally it's open now. Now, what does this have to do with anything? The fact is, I was thinking that, you know, and I just happened to kind of look it up because I went, I wanted to get this bridge done. And it turned out that they do yearly reports, engineering reports on all the bridges, and the state does, on state highways, and they found that this one was in poor condition a few years ago. So they finally got around to allocating the funds to fix it. I was thinking, well, I'm glad that somebody has an engineering degree and is, like, examining the bridges and fixing the bridges so I don't drive over them and fall in, you know, crash to my death, you know, in the river below. You know, I mean, in other words, we use our intelligence where we need to. We use science in agriculture, right? We use science in taking care of our cows. If our cow is sick, what do? Well, we do what we can if we know how to do it, but if it's beyond us, we call a veterinarian. We call people who are educated. And it's not that, we think, oh, you wonderful veterinarian, I bow down to your lotus feet. No, we use them to help us serve Krishna. We use intelligence, we use knowledge. You know, whether it's building temples or fixing cars or going to the doctor, whatever it is. All these occupations were part of the Varnashram system. In other words, all people can be devotees and they can do any kind of work and they can use that knowledge that they need to know in that work for Krishna's service. So getting back to the study of knowledge, which is called epistemology and philosophy, in the Vedas, and we've heard this probably before, there's different processes of knowledge, what they call different evidences or praman. Praman means basically evidence. What evidence do I have that something's true? And so, in the Srimad Bhagavatam 11.19.17, it describes, it says, from the four types of evidence, Vedic knowledge, direct experience, traditional wisdom, and logical induction, one can understand the temporary insubstantial situation of the material world by which one becomes detached from the duality of this world. Now, what's interesting about this verse, now we've many times, Prabhupada's written different purports about the failings of these different types of knowing and why we accept Shabda or Shruti. We accept spiritual knowledge, we accept direct descending knowledge rather than ascending knowledge. We all have heard this. And this is true, absolutely true, and we know this. But now what's interesting about this verse and the purports, especially, well, they took most of it from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's purport, is Vishwanath describes how we can use all of these four processes positively. You know, and in this case, the verse was from Bhagavatam, how one understands the temporary nature of the material world. So it's kind of interesting. We have Shruti, Vedic evidence. We have Pratyaksha, direct experience. Atitihyam, traditional wisdom, and Anuman, or logical induction. So the Bhagavatam gives both positive applications of these to understand the truth, and it also describes their limitations. So the strengths given by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, and also Jiva, I forget which Sandarbha it is, but Jiva Goswami also quotes this verse and then talks about it too, and talks about these ways of knowledge. And Vishnu says, first of all, pratyaksha, by observation, he says, buildings, bodies, empires come and go. We see a clay is made into a pot, then destroyed, returns to the clay. He says, so simply by observation, by pratyaksha, we can understand the material world is temporary. He says, in traditional wisdom, he gives the example, the world never changes. Apparently back in the 1600s, 1700s, they had this expression, as the world never changes. And think of others, everything is temporary. The only constant is change, right? In other words, we have this, these things we call these sayings, adages, aphorisms, traditional wisdom, folk wisdom. Sometimes they're true, and sometimes they help us to understand things. Sometimes they're way off base, but we have to evaluate. And they also show logically how one concludes. We see that everything is impermanent. We see everything around us in the material world comes and goes, is destroyed. Therefore, we can, by inference, understand the material creation as temporary. So we can, and of course, obviously, we have Shastric evidence using Shruti. So we can use all of these types of evidence. They can be very valuable to us in trying to understand things, even understanding the spiritual world. And of course, you know, I noticed right in the beginning when I became a devotee how Prabhupada always used so many analogies, right? So many examples. You know, we've got the hot iron rod and the fire. We have to describe how we're very small and Krishna's great. We've got the ocean, you know, and the drop of water in the ocean, same substance. You know, right? There's so many of these examples, and they're all in the Bhagavatam too. That was then what I later discovered as we got through more and got more and more cantos available, that almost all of these expressions Prabhupada used, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj used, and the Bhagavatam uses all throughout. You know, there's all these different examples are given. And Vishnu says that, you know, that when we're describing something, the Bhagavatam also uses a positive example and a negative example to show what it is and what it isn't. So it's actually a very good process of learning that we get right from the Bhagavatam, and also some of Rupa Goswami's works are like that too. You know, he'll say like, you know, this is what devotion, or the famous Anya Bilasita Shunyam verse says, this is what pure devotional service is, this is what it isn't, right? So in other words, all of this is there. Now, the limitations, of course, are that, well, there's many limitations. Sometimes these different types of evidence are contradictory. You know, like traditional versus empiric. We might have a saying, but then, well, that doesn't really make sense, you know, whatever. So we have limitations. And we know, especially like direct experience or prajaksha or inductive knowledge, two real issues there. Prabhupada's talked about a lot, the four defects. We make mistakes. We have imperfect senses. The propensity to cheat. And we're always in illusion. And these are pretty easy to see, limitations. One example is given, it's like you put a stick in a glass of water and it appears bent, right? Because of the refraction of light. So I can say, no, I saw that stick is bent. In other words, we can't always trust exactly what we see. Prabhupada gives an example, he says, we can't even see what's behind us. Our eyes only go in one direction. So we could see many, many examples like this about the limitations of our senses. So it's our senses, or extensions of our senses through things like telescopes, microscopes, you know, through different instruments. It's still the same idea. It's just extending the ability of those senses to perceive. And of course, we know the cheating propensity is there. There's so much bluffing. Knowledge is generally speculative, changing. I was reading someday and all different figures, but I finally came up with probably what was kind of the most generally true statement. That about 55% of scientists, material scientists, do not believe in the theory of evolution. You know, which when I was a child in school, we were told this is the absolute truth. You know, this is fact. You know, and if you doubt it, you're like some, you know, strange born-again Christian or something, you know, right? So, but no, it's like now over half the scientists say, well, it may be kind of true, but there's so many holes in it, so many things that don't hold up like that. And that knowledge changes continually. You know, 600 years ago, they said the Earth was flat. No one knew anything about the germ theory. Talk about subatomic particles discovered in 1953, right? So,
they didn't think the Earth was flat.
What's that?
They didn't think the Earth was flat
They didn't.
No.
How long ago?
Never. Some people always.
Well, Copernicus didn't, and there were those who obviously.
The ancient Greeks, the Jyotishas in India.
Okay. Okay, good.
Bad
example, maybe. Okay, but anyway, we know some people did. But Columbus was. Yes, people still do it. It's a flat earth society to this day. Well, yeah, I mean, well, devotees will latch on to any conspiracy or strange theory that you can come up with. You'll find some devotee adhering to it. You know, they should. Now, as far as, which is strange, because the Srimad Bhagavatam clearly talks about all the planets being globes floating in space. Thousands and thousands of years ago, the Vedic literature, the Srimad Bhagavatam tells us about planetary systems that are fairly accurate. I mean, from a scientific point of view, of course they're accurate, but even from a scientific understanding, they're pretty accurate. And like I say, subatomic particles, they knew about atoms. There's the third canto, a chapter called Calculation of the Time by the Atoms. You know, it's like these things have been known for a long, long time, you know, by devotees, because it's all part. There is a certain science and understanding of this material world. It is real. It does have an absolute reality in nature. And, you know, devotees can figure it out. Non-devotees can figure out some of it. Let's put it that way. At any rate, and we all know that as going on, that logic, rational argument only goes so far. Prabhupada gave the example of what this deductive process, or what's it called? Oh, it's Anuman, the logical induction. He said the example is all men are mortal. Yeah, all men are mortal. John is a man, therefore John is mortal. Right? In other words, that's a logical, and Prabhupada gives that example, that's a logical progression. You can't really deny it. You know, it's sort of a. We used to study that back when I was in debate camp, you know, in a former lifetime, you know, like the P, if P not Q, or all those sort of, I can't even remember them anymore. But, you know, so, and in fact, speaking of it, when I was on the debate team, it's interesting because we take a big question, you know, facing the world, like, you know, should we continue military assistance to, you know, and you pick a side, for or against. And you could argue like anything and make a great case for it, and the other side would go and make a great case against it. So what was the truth? It was kind of like whoever spoke the best and had the best, you know, won. You know, whoever had the most convincing or defeated the other one, it didn't have anything to do with, we didn't even care what the, you know, what the reality was, what mattered. You know, it was just a matter of doing the debate. And so that's what you see. You see so much of this where logic and reason is limited. I give an example of Immanuel Kant's antinomies. His antinomies were, he would set up you talk about reality, is there God, time, you know, really big philosophical questions, and he'd make an argument for it, and then he'd make an argument against it. Both of them seem convincing, you know. And Prabhupada would do that sometimes. He would, with his disciples, he would argue for something, sound really good, then he'd take the other side. And, of course, who's most famous for doing that? Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he was a scholar in Nadia, right? I mean, people were just, everyone ran from him. They were afraid to debate him. Didn't matter what side you took, he would defeat it. Then he'd turn around and convince you the other way. So that's the problem and limitation of even logic. Now, I think the Aitihashya, traditional wisdom, is interesting. Now, it doesn't have a lot of value, except perhaps in Vaishnava culture, where, you know, Chanaka Pandit or some of these sayings, you know, have a lot of truth to them. The only thing I can't remember what the source is, but I hate to say this, but those comic books, remember? They would have these folk tales, or they were like Aesop's fables, but the Vedic version. Where did that come from? Does anyone know? Okay. Yeah, so I mean, it was kind of bona fide, I guess. I mean, it was, you know, it was originally probably in some scripture, Mahabharata or something, some of these stories. A lot of them were from Mahabharata, you know, and those were good. Okay, those are good folk wisdom that helped teach values, you know, traditional values. But they call this, in social psychology, they call it naive realism, which I have written down, is the human tendency to believe what we see, how we see the world around us is objective. And the people who disagree with us must be uninformed, irrational, or biased. Or just dumb, you know, stupid. I mean, that's what we think. The way I see it must be the right way. You know, so it's called sometimes folk psychology or common sense psychology. And it's the ability, everyone thinks that they kind of know what's going on. I can explain what's happening. I can explain behavior, even if I am totally unqualified. And so out of some of these common cultural sayings or adages, they're often contradictory. I was thinking of some of these, like absence makes the heart grow fonder, but also out of sight, out of mind. You know, they're opposite. Opposites attract, or birds of a feather flock together. So many of these things are nothing more than just kind of interesting sayings and, you know, that may actually be opposing to each other. Now, of course, the other big issue with all of these ways of knowing, the real main problem is we don't understand, or we cannot, through them, understand underlying causation. Okay? In other words, we understand only sort of the material aspect or what we see in front of us. So the philosophical issue of causation, of course, is discussed extensively by Prabhupada and Srimad Bhagavatam. The creation and development of the material world, there's basically two perspectives, according to Jiva Goswami. He says we have the immediate material cause, which is called pradana, and the remote or spiritual cause, nimitta. And Prabhupada uses these in several purports. He talks about immediate cause and remote cause. So science and our direct experience and all of this offers immediate cause. You know, it tells us how things are happening. Okay, here's the material energy, and when the material energy reacts this way, we can explain that a little bit. You know, in other words, I can explain water is made out of, what, two hydrogen elements and one oxygen. H2O, yeah, and one oxygen. They've figured that out. They've explained it. Yes, that is what waters, the elements are combined. But where did the water come from? Who made it? How did it get? You know, it's like you go beyond that to final causation, and it's philosophy becomes a little bit short. The philosophical approach is to try to find causes behind everything. But without spiritual knowledge and without accepting Shruti and Shabda, accepting authority, it's very difficult. And you end up with many, many different theories that are contradictory or don't explain things. You know, my one semester I was a philosophy major. We used to go to these colloquiums where the advanced graduate students or the professors would, you know, put out, you know, some philosophical point. And then basically they all tried to tear it apart from each other, you know, and contradict it. So and you always had to come up with something new that contradicted the other thing. So that's kind of where it was at. So in 11.4.27, the Bhagavatam verse is, when an expert physician treats a patient, he tries to find the original cause of the disease and is not diverted by the symptoms of that original cause. Right? In other words, we can all understand that. If you're only dealing with the symptoms, okay, you've got this, this, and this, but what causes it? So what does the doctor do? He orders tests, through observation, through so many ways, tries to discover what is the cause, then they can come up with the cure, theoretically at least. So material vision only sees symptoms of the interactions of the modes of nature. So we need to find not only the immediate but the remote cause. In philosophy, sometimes that's called the final cause, is called telos, which means purpose or the end or the aim or the goal of something. And teleology is a philosophical account that accounts for the final causes that exist in nature. So as I said, philosophers sometimes do try to discover this, but it can be very, very difficult without higher knowledge. 4.31.18 says, because the Supreme Lord is the cause of all causes, He is the super soul of all individual living entities, and He exists as both the remote and immediate cause. This again is the two. So we understand Krishna is the supreme cause behind material nature. Krishna says, Maya dakshina prakriti suyate satracharam. This material nature is working under my direction. And also 4.31.17, the verse before the one I read, says that Krishna is sarva karma karanam, the cause of all causes. And that's what we're looking for. When you philosophically are trying to you know, find out what is the meaning of life, what is all about. You ultimately want to know what is the cause of all causes. You'll say, well, God was. They'll say, well, where did God come from? You know, the smart alecks. You know, so you say, well, you know, you get to a certain point where Krishna is Sarvakarana Karanam, the cause of all causes. There has to be one origin, one original, one Adi Purusha. So that verse, Prabhupada says, Krishna is the remote cause and the material cause. Let's try that again. Krishna is the remote cause and material nature is the immediate cause of the cosmic manifestation. Material nature is the immediate cause of the cosmic manifestation, but the original cause is Narayan, Krishna. Sometimes people think the cause of an earthen pot is the earth. We see on a potter's wheel sufficient amount of earth to produce many pots, and an unintelligent man will say the earth on the wheel is the cause of the pot. Those who are actually advanced will find the original cause is the potter, who supplies the earth and moves the wheel. So material nature may be a helping factor in the creation of cosmic manifestation, but it's not the ultimate cause. In other words, you have all these material elements, right? You got the five gross elements, the three sub. Those have no life. They can do nothing. They have no movement until they are activated by spirit. So either the living entity, Jiva, who is spirit, inhabits a material body, and all of those material elements are activated, or Krishna comes into the material world through his different, you know, the different Vishnu and different expansions. Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, Kshiradakshaya Vishnu come into this material world and activate it. And once it's activated by the Supreme Lord, then everything comes into motion. Life comes into being. I mean, life is already there, of course, but life manifests through all these different bodies and things that we see in this material world. So, of course, I have 5 minutes and a couple of huge topics here, like why do we accept the authority of scriptures? Is it only faith? Well, no. people have faith in everything. Everyone has faith, I should say. Everyone has some faith, right? And yet, so many things we can't see, we don't know. We can't see atoms. Why do I even believe there are atoms? I've heard it from authority, right? They're far plant radio waves, internet. Can we see these things? Do we even understand these? I have no idea how the internet works, to be honest. I mean, I kind of got a preliminary, I could, you know, say a few things, but I don't really know. You know, how airplanes fly. Prabhupada said it's almost mystic power, right? how an airplane can stay up in the air. So we accept so many things on authority. And so we have to develop faith in spiritual authority. And it's funny because people accept authority from anyone on any material subject. Oh yes, he's an authority. That person, I learned from him. This is my teacher, right? We always find it. You want to be a carpenter, best thing to do. You know, find a master carpenter, apprentice with them, learn. Or at least read books by people who know. But spiritual life, no, I know everything. No, I'll figure it out myself. It's not an intelligent approach. We have to find those people who know and develop spiritual faith from authorities. So, I think another question is spiritual authority and what we learn from the scriptures, is it corroborated by direct experience? We're sort of talking about the connection between experience, material experience, and whatever in spiritual life. But do we actually have direct experience of those things that are stated by the spiritual teachers, the spiritual master, by the scriptures? I would again say yes. A person can have direct experience of spiritual truth. Even at the beginning stage, like us, of devotional service, it's possible. What to speak of one who is a pure devotee, who has become perfected in this process, can fully understand everything from within. The Bhagavad Gita 4:38 says, and one who has become accomplished in the practice of devotional service enjoys this knowledge within himself in due course of time. In other words, as one performs devotional service through bhakti, the heart becomes purified, and the super soul shines forth from the heart. The spirit soul shines forth, and the spirit soul is enlightened by the super soul and understands everything. And of course, Later, as one becomes more advanced in bhakti, one experiences Radha Krishna directly within the heart, who enlighten one all along the way. And of course, we have the famous Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam verse 9.2. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets, is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it's the perfection of religion. Direct perception of the self by realization. And what the word is used is prajaksha here, the same word is just used for direct experience. So this prajaksha, direct experience, will be realized by the devotee who understands this pure knowledge. Srila Prabhupada said, "It is said that the execution of devotional service is so perfect that one can perceive the results directly. This direct result is actually perceived, and we have practical experience that anyone who is chanting the holy names of Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, in course of chanting without offenses, feels some transcendental pleasure and very quickly becomes purified of all material contamination. This is actually seen. Furthermore, if one engages not only in hearing but in trying to broadcast the message of devotional service, of devotional activities as well, or if he engages himself in helping the missionary activities of Krishna consciousness, he gradually feels spiritual progress." So spiritual life and progress is personally experienced within, Srila Prabhupada is saying. Of course, he says, by chanting defenselessly. So it's not always so difficult to achieve, and we may not have entire direct experience of Krishna consciousness at our current stage, which is for most of us is like the Namabhasa stage, the purifying stage, until we come to the platform of Shuddha Bhakti, of pure chanting. But as we do more and more, that direct experience is there. So in the purport, 438, it said, "Ignorance is the cause of our bondage and knowledge is the cause of our liberation. Spiritual life means we cultivate vidya, spiritual knowledge, which destroys ignorance of vidya, which is the root cause of suffering of living entity." So how do we obtain this knowledge? Through bhakti. It always comes down to that. It's the purifying process, and that gives us our qualification. How do we become enlightened within the heart by super soul? How do we gain this direct experience? By bhakti. By becoming purified and pleasing Krishna. And of course, we please Krishna by pleasing his devotees, beginning with the spiritual master. And then the spiritual master takes that devotional service on up and finally recommends us to Radharani, who says, "Krishna, here's a very nice devotee," Prabhupada said. And then we get the blessings. We get the blessings of not only of, as Prabhupada says, of spiritual pleasure, but also of transcendental knowledge. One becomes enlightened within the heart. Bhagavad Gita 18.55 says, "Bhakti mama bhajananti yavanyaschasvitatvataha tato mam tapato gyatva vishyate tadanantaram." One can understand me as I am, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, only by devotional service. And when one is in full consciousness of me by such devotion, he can enter into the kingdom of God. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nam Vishwadaya Krishna. Is there any questions or comments?
I was just thinking how, there's the four kinds of men that come to Krishna consciousness. Distressed, desire of wealth, inquisitive, and those who are searching after the absolute. And in the case of ourselves, like at the beginning of the movement, it was mainly just Prabhupada, and his purity. Of course, he had the whole, Vedic scriptures behind him to call upon, all of that. But it was just his, really, it was his purity, I think, most that just struck us, that we'd never met or seen anyone like that. And of course, then as he gave classes, we learned so much, but
Yeah, then you receive that causeless mercy, the spiritual master.
Yeah, Guru Kripa, right?
Yeah, Kali Yuga, it seems like there was a lot of causeless mercy for us.
Yeah. And it's still like that in so many ways. Like, you know, people, there's so many philosophies. And I know before I became devotee, I studied so many different philosophies. But, so the Krishna consciousness is another philosophy, but more than that was the was Prabhupada, and the, like you said, and the devotees. When you met the devotee, it was like, wow, he's a really amazing personality.
Oh, it's incredibly powerful. I was thinking, speaking of reading all these philosophies, I read this entire, like, 900-page book on the teachings of Ramakrishna, and somehow or another, Prabhupada immediately cut through all of that, and all that impersonalism is gone. You know, I mean, it's like,
yeah.
Oh, boy, if you can overcome that, that's pretty powerful. But, yeah, it's there. Although, you could see the four kinds of people, too. I mean, you know, there was some distress that we all experienced. We saw the suffering material world. We probably were seeking knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, we wanted to know philosophically what was life about and like that. So I think we could also fall into those categories. But many people could also fall in those categories, and they don't come to Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's also described the four kinds of people in the next verse that don't come to, who never surrender. Which is really the issue, isn't it? That how does one really surrender to the spiritual master and to Krishna Gosh to accept this? You know, and I think that's where there's just a lot of mercy comes into play.
Yeah.
You know, Chris, some of you were very sincere, probably had lifetimes of devotional service. Some of us, just a lot of causeless mercy.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, those four things, it's like, it can be an impetus for surrender, but there's got to be some piety and mercy there, because, you know, you do, I mean, there's a lot of people who have those problems, and, you know, they're going anyway. So,
yeah, and they don't go.
Yeah.
Well, one thing
Vishnu... It says in the pious.
One thing Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about in this, he says it's agyata sukriti, that is unseen benefit, which has to do with association with devotees, devotional service. I think Rupa Goswami gives example of people who may have seen the Rath Yatra parade, or, you know, I mean, all these examples are there, taken Vrishadam. And so that Vishnu says that Agyata Sukriti builds to a point where faith can develop and one can accept the philosophy, one can understand or surrender. Yeah.
Yeah, on the flat earth. I mean, because it's, you know, because we're doing a project, we're going to publish something here with B.I. and Richard Thompson, Arca.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is not new. It has nothing to do with modern West. It has nothing to do with science, whatever. You know, as was mentioned, within the Vedic culture, because these Jyotishas definitely, you know, we have a few of their major texts, and they definitely identify with Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, Sarasvati, and their invocations. But they are calculating. They're doing, and they're doing a lot of pioneering work that's recognizing the history of mathematics, what to speak of the Hindu Arabic numerals, which came out of this tradition. But they were quantifying the earth as a globe, and they were also trying to reconcile, because they knew the Puranas, you know, and they were Vedic Brahmins. That's how they were recognized. You know how to reconcile that with descriptions in the Puranas of billions of mile wide. You know, this Bhumandala plane.
It can be difficult for people.
Well, it's part of the tradition, you could say, you know, and this is, goes to the philosophical point of, you know, we have things that we perceive and things that we hear, and they may not necessarily be contradictory, but from our perspective, we don't see how they all fit together in a larger picture.
Yeah, I was always very, very confused, especially by cosmology. I heard someone who had been studying it, like Govinda Sarup once, or, you know, who was part of that team and studying it a lot, and somehow the way they explained it started to make sense. You know, in other words, the Vedic version, if you've got to look at it in a different way. It's almost like dimensionally and everything. You know, I can't repeat it, but I mean, it started to come together. You know, when you look at it from a very elevated perspective by those who have really gotten into this.
Yeah, because we have a few of the major texts from the Jyotishas, because they say, you know, we don't have everything at all. But, you know, they're also grappling with that, you know, different perceptions, levels of perception, this and that. And they're also grappling with sometimes, perhaps it's a simplistic interpretation, well, it's just flat, like you take the earth and squash it like the UN map, you know. And they're saying, well, you know, if we perceive it as a globe, you take 1/100th of it, you know, that could look flat.
Look flat, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that's a definitive argument, but, you know, this is like from 700, you know, this is a record we have, so it didn't start there, this discussion. I mean, they were, you know, how to deal with it intellectually, I think it's not new. And,
yeah.
And that's part of the process, perhaps.
Yeah.
That's part of the process.
Interesting. I mean, I know that the TVOP team, as far as the planetarium, I mean, they've been working for years and discussing and debating, probably, you know, and saying, you know, which text and which person, and trying to get in experts from India. And, you know, it hasn't been easy at all, you know, for them to, even the devotees, to come to an agreement on what does this really look like. Because it's not just like, oh, I can see it, read it abstractly. They had to, as Prabhupada wanted, put it out there visually in the planetarium. And that's a struggle, you can imagine. Yeah. And the thing is, when one has a very scientific approach, then sometimes it almost becomes more difficult to accept, say, the Puranas or Jyoti or some of the Vedic explanations, you know, because it can be very contradictory to what you spent years of your life studying. So, you know. And it has been a problem for some devotees, actually. You know, I don't know if some of you are around, but early on when the fifth canto was published, Srila Prabhupada says some devotees will leave after reading the fifth canto, and it happened. In the temple I was at, two of our very intelligent devotees who were doing the college preaching programs couldn't accept it, and they left the movement. Yeah. Okay.
There's one online question, if you have time.
Oh, okay.
From Sudama Prabhu. Says, sometimes we meet a person who is strong-willed, who has some shakti. Can a relatively weak-willed devotee ever hope to defeat such a person?
Interesting. I think you can defeat people, but you may not convert them or change their mind, because that really has to come from the heart. You know, and that may take some time. It's just, sometimes it's a process of the person having a lot of contact, a lot of purification. You know. But could you defeat them? You could say, a devotee onlooker might say, oh, he defeated him because the arguments, the logic, and scripture was better. But if the person really isn't changing or they're not convinced, I always felt it wasn't worth arguing with people who strongly opposed or... You know, I always thought it was best to try to engage them somehow. And also show them some kindness, some love, some mercy. You know, the devotees are people of good quality. Because a lot of them, you're not going to convince. No matter what, how good your arguments are and how philosophically strong you are. Okay? Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.